is Tuesday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, as mourners file past the coffin of former President George H.W. Bush, we look back at his presidency.
I don't think he was appreciated in his time exactly because there was not a lot of flash, a lot of theatrics coming out of his administration.
The French government suspends a controversial fuel tax hike, and the U.S. Botanic Garden here in Washington features historic trains to commemorate the holiday season. It's all ahead. Streams of mourners filed past the flag-draped casket of former U.S. President George H.W. Bush in the U.S. Capitol Tuesday, a day ahead of the state funeral for the country's 41st president. U.S. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump were set to privately offer their condolences to Bush's son, former President George W. Bush, the country's 43rd president, former First Lady Laura Bush, and other Bush family members at Blair House, the presidential guest house across the street from the White House. U.S. political dignitaries praised George H.W. Bush as an American hero in World War II, a statesman, a world leader, and perhaps most of all, as a decent man full of grace. Bush died last week at the age of 94 at his home in Texas after years of failing health. Mark Rozelle is dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia and author of the book Power and Prudence, The Presidency of George H.W. Bush. He tells me that the late president was a transitional figure between Presidents Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton.
In many ways, Bush was a transitional figure. He was the last of a generation that, of course, was out of World War II. He was a fighter pilot there. Bill Clinton represented a new emerging trend in American politics that was very different from really the older generation that George H.W. Bush represented. And also, he was quite a contrast in style. Ronald Reagan, of course, very charismatic leader, able to give the great speech. George H.W. Bush recognized he simply could not be Reagan. He tried to tamp down expectations for charismatic leadership and big, bold gestures coming out of the White House and to present a much more modest, I think, consolidating style of leadership rather than bold gestures and major new initiatives. And I don't think he was appreciated in his time exactly because there was not a lot of flash, a lot of theatrics coming out of his administration and because of his really very low-key style. But that ultimately didn't sit well with many Americans in the 1992 election. They wanted something different. And many saw that Bill Clinton represented more of the future and George H.W. Bush represented the past.
Well, and I suppose also during that campaign, Bush was portrayed as an elite person because of his family background, his education at Yale, and he was perhaps viewed as out of touch. I remember those pictures of him at a grocery store at a scanner, and he looked like he was kind of amazed by it.
Yes, yeah, but the grocery scanner story really hit home for a lot of people because that represented in many ways a president who was out of touch with ordinary Americans. So the Democrats made fun of him, saying that he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth and that he had been, driven in a limousine to kindergarten and so forth. I mean, all of this was exaggerated, but the point was that he came from a patrician background, very privileged, and during a very heated recession that created a great deal of economic anxiety in the country, many people saw George H.W. Bush as simply not being in touch with the suffering of ordinary Americans, not really having a clue what to do about the domestic economy. And that's what created the opening politically for Bill Clinton. Now, I would give George H.W. Bush a lot of credit in the sense that he accepted a budget compromise that he knew was politically unpopular. It had the tax increase in it that he said he would never do. And he also, during the campaign, refused advice from his political advisors to create a government stimulus to the economy to give it an immediate shock and give people some hope that he was in control of the economy, could do something about it. He believed it was the worst thing we could do. We saw the recovery happen after his defeat. I think he took the responsible position from a policy standpoint, but from a political one, I think it ultimately hurt him.
He was president also at a very key time at the end of the Cold War when the Berlin Wall fell, and he has been, perhaps retroactively, very much praised for his conduct during that time.
He is praised today for his conduct during the massive transitions that took place in the international environment while he was president, particularly the breakup of the old Soviet Union. But interestingly, in his time, he took a lot of criticism for not bragging about we won the Cold War, for not doing a big public dance showing off that the United States had prevailed in the long Cold War. He was an old-style politician with a diplomatic background who, you know, believed in a sort of low-key style and personal relationships and not bragging, not making a big show. And interestingly, many people in his time saw that as a kind of lack of leadership coming from him. They had been used to, I think, a much more publicly overt, theatrical style of leadership from his predecessor, Ronald Reagan. And a lot of his contemporaries wonder, why is George Bush being so quiet during such a profound change in the world's history? And it just didn't suit his style. He had a different way of proceeding. And ultimately, I think many people thought that the president should have been a little bit more out there in a very public, visible way, showcasing his accomplishments and the role he played in those transitions.
Mark Rozell, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University and author of the book Power and Prudence, The Presidency of George H.W. Bush. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Ukraine says Russia is allowing some ships to enter the Azov seaports. Former Vice President Joe Biden says he is the most qualified person in the country to be president. CIA Director Gina Haspel will brief lawmakers on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And the U.S. calls for a reform of global institutions. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
On August 21, 2017, a total solar eclipse followed a northwest to southeast path across the United States. A number of researchers from various scientific disciplines used the solar eclipse to conduct experiments. Researchers at the University of Missouri put together a group of citizen scientists along with elementary students and their teachers to study how a solar eclipse affects bees. 16 acoustic monitoring stations were placed along the total eclipse path in Oregon, Idaho, and Missouri. The monitoring stations were placed in locations where bees would congregate, such as flower patches. As the total eclipse made its way over each monitoring station, the researchers listened for the sound of bees buzzing, or as they found out, not buzzing. During the periods of totality, the bees took a break from their daily routines. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe seems to be entering a new phase. We'll have a report. France's government has suspended a deeply unpopular planned fuel tax hike that unleashed nationwide protests by so-called yellow vests, a leaderless movement angry over the high cost of living and a government it claims cares only about the rich. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports for VOA that initial reactions, though, suggest the crisis is far from over, with many calling the measures insufficient.
After months of ramming through unpopular reforms, the government of President Emmanuel Macron essentially made a U-turn by suspending a fuel tax increase set for January 1st, along with a planned hike for heating prices. The six-month moratorium aims to allow time for dialogue to help end Macron's biggest crisis since taking office last year. Announcing the moratorium, Prime Minister Edouard Philippe said he understood people's pain.
Cette colère, il faudrait être sourd ou aveugle pour ne pas la voir.
Philippe said you'd have to be deaf and blind not to understand the public anger. No tax warrants putting the nation's unity in danger, he said, noting more than 3 weeks of massive protests have left 4 people dead, hundreds injured, and have hit the economy hard. The violence, he said, has to stop. The Prime Minister's tone contrasted sharply with what critics claim is an arrogant administration, uncaring about working and middle-class concerns.
Ensuite, si les impôts baissent, il faudra que les dépenses
but Philippe said any tax relief would mean cuts in public spending to meet France's European Union budget obligations and not to sink into further debt. And he said the government will keep promoting green policies. It claimed the fuel tax hike is necessary to fight climate change. Initial reactions suggest the protests are likely to continue.
On commence à nous entendre. Maintenant, on n'est pas totalement satisfait parce que
Lionel Cucci, a yellow vest representative from the southern Bouches-du-Rhône region, told France's BFM TV the government is beginning to listen. But people aren't satisfied because the tax increase is only suspended and not dropped. Some hardliners are even calling for the government to resign and new elections to be held. Environmentalists are also unhappy, but for different reasons. Lucille Dufour with Climate Action Network called the fuel tax suspension an unacceptable rollback on climate commitments by the French government.
If the government wants to be credible on the fight against climate change, if the government wants to actually accelerate the fight against climate change to respond to the, for instance, to the IPCC 1.5 report that was just released, the government has to maintain this carbon tax.
Dufour says the government can take measures that would help struggling French citizens cope with the fuel tax hikes and also meet its climate commitments. For VOA News, I'm Lisa Bryant in Paris.
President Donald Trump said he wants to end the arms race. In a tweet Monday, Trump, at some time in the future, said President Xi Jinping, President Vladimir Putin of Russia, and I will start talking about, in his words, a meaningful halt to what has become a major and uncontrollable arms race. He said the $716 billion the U.S. spent on defense this year is crazy. Speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty, John Tierney, executive director of the Washington-based Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, agrees, but said the president is partly to blame.
I think he's right that it's crazy that this country spent $716 billion, but he's as much to blame for it as anybody else. He signed the bill, and he didn't really come back with any alternatives, of which there are plenty. And if he's talking about an arms race that it seems uncontrollable, well, he's aiding and abetting that ability. He can certainly participate in controlling it. The United States always had a leadership role in doing that since the days of Ronald Reagan, and he and John Bolton and company have sort of abdicated that. So I think we should encourage him to have those conversations. We should think about it. The sooner it starts, the better. He ought to do it at a high level with, you know, people that understand what they're doing. That, you know, we have diplomats that have experience in this area, that are knowledgeable. He just can't go about it as he's been prone to do in the past, sitting down himself and thinking that the three principals are going to chat it out without doing an awful lot of groundwork and having a lot of people that are very, very knowledgeable about these areas get involved and start working on it.
Do you see a possible opening that would make the presidents of China and Russia amenable to such talks?
I do. Look, even back in the days when Ronald Reagan thought that Russia was the evil empire, and we had any number of disputes and disagreements with that country, that is the Soviet Union, they found a way to separate out the existential issue of nuclear weapons. This is a serious thing that can affect humanity. So we have to be able to do that. And even though we have disagreements with Russia and some contention on trade and other issues with China, we certainly can carve out this issue, the existential threat of nuclear weapons and mistake or miscalculation or other things can go wrong and start addressing those. And we ought to do that because it opens up a path to have conversations about a host of other things as well. But, you know, this is a serious matter, and most people who, you know, in this country would love to see some serious negotiations to start to try to decrease the nuclear arsenals, and in fact, the entire arsenals of these countries, and start moving back to the path that we have been on for decades until more recently.
Isn't the president on record as advocating a modernization of the nuclear program?
He's on record. Some Democrats and Republicans are on record. China and Russia are on record. Other countries, France, everybody are talking about modernizing their arsenals. And the idea is, if you are talking about making sure that what you have as a deterrent is safe and secure, that's one aspect of modernization. And I think people can say, well, if you still believe in deterrence and that's your path, then you do want to make sure things are safe and secure. But if you're using modernization as a ruse to just have an arms race, to have more weapons of different components and different degrees of magnitude and move in that direction, then modernization is not what should be happening. So maybe the terminology to use instead of modernization is just securing and safe, making safe what's there as a deterrent, and then continue to negotiate, get back, I should say, to negotiating a decrease in the arsenals and finding ways to have communication between countries to lower the temperature of any disputes and start dealing with them diplomatically as opposed to making threats and building up your arms.
John Tierney said rather than threatening to withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Forces nuclear treaty with Moscow, the Trump administration should engage the Russians over its concerns of treaty violations. He also said it's time to extend the new START arms control agreement, which is to expire in 2021, to give both sides a sense of security and understanding into the nature of each country's arsenal. The Russia probe, led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, appears to be entering a new phase in the wake of last week's guilty plea by Michael Cohen, who had long served as President Donald Trump's personal attorney. In the wake of the Cohen plea, legal analysts are debating whether the Russia investigation is moving toward a conclusion, and if so, what the stakes could be for the president and for the country. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
In a series of Monday tweets, President Trump slammed Special Counsel Robert Mueller and Michael Cohen, the president's former personal lawyer. Last week in New York, Cohen pleaded guilty to lying to Congress, having misled lawmakers about President Trump's interest in a building project in Russia while he was running for president. The president said he is not worried about what else Cohen might tell investigators.
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm not worried at all about him.
The Cohen plea moves the Russia investigation closer to possible ties between then-candidate Trump and Russia, says Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
This is one more example of one of the president's closest allies lying about their ties to Russia and Russians.
Senator Warner and North Carolina Republican Senator Richard Burr lead the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election.
Our mandate is at the end of this to get as close to the clear truth as we possibly can. And we can't do it on conjecture. We've got to do it on facts.
Recent developments suggest the Russia probe, led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, could be heading for a climax, says legal analyst Rick Simmons.
I would expect that we'd see some sort of conclusion of this within the next few months. Again, he doesn't have a timeline that he's required to meet by law, and he doesn't have to tell us where he is, so we can't know for sure.
The Cohen plea, along with past indictments and guilty pleas, have bolstered the credibility of the Russia probe, even though the president continues to dismiss it as a witch hunt. Legal expert Doug Spencer.
But it does, I think, add more legitimacy to the investigation that there's actually a lot of smoke going on in this particular realm that deserves investigation. I think it undercuts the claims that this is a hoax or that it's a witch hunt.
Mueller has said nothing about where the investigation is headed, but 2019 could prove to be a pivotal year, says analyst Simmons.
He's done a lot of work with other witnesses that have flipped, and that he's had months to work with them too. So I would expect that we'd see some sort of conclusion of this within the next few months.
The investigation could move toward a climax just as Democrats take control of the House of Representatives and as the president prepares for his own re-election bid in 2020. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Every year, thousands of visitors come to the U.S. Botanic Garden here in Washington to enjoy the Christmas decorations, holiday plants, and model trains. This year, the garden has its largest ever display of toy trains chugging around historic railroad stations in the United States. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, the railroad stations are made from some unusual materials.
It is cold outside in Washington, but there is a warm glow inside the U.S. Botanic Garden during the Christmas season. This year, the garden is featuring 31 replicas of historic U.S. train stations built from the 1800s to 1970.
Trains really celebrate the holiday season for people from 2 to 92.
Kashmira Bhatti came to see the trains with her son.
He likes that the trains are moving, and he can see the train station and the surrounding of the train station, too. So it's more like an educational thing for him, and plus entertainment, too.
The amazing displays are reminiscent of the popular model trains that circled under Christmas trees for 50 years during the last century, from 1910 to 1960. And while the trains may be a new experience for kids, they bring back nostalgia for adults old enough to remember them.
And I think there's still a little bit of an imaginative era associated with trains in the United States. It's something that not everyone rides all the time anymore, and so I think there's a little bit of whimsy associated with them.
Most of the train stations are still in existence, including Montana's East Glacier Park Station, the beautiful Cincinnati Union Terminal in Ohio, and the very steep Pikes Peak Cog Railway in Colorado. If you look closely, you will also see something else that is unique about the railroad stations and other structures. They were constructed using a variety of plant-based materials.
So the buildings are made out of things like acorns or cinnamon sticks, grapevine tendrils. In fact, there's more than 100 different type of plant parts that are used to make these.
Besides the historic train stations, the Botanic Garden is also featuring its spectacular plant-based collection of Washington landmarks, which include the White House, U.S. Capitol, and the U.S. Supreme Court, along with the newest addition, the city's Union Station. This visitor was admiring the intricate workmanship that went into making the landmarks and railroad stations.
The ingenuity, the creativity. I love all of the natural elements. It's fantastic.
Also showcased are two of the largest indoor decorated Christmas trees in Washington, as well as more than 3,000 poinsettia plants, also known as the Christmas flower. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
It sounds like a very heartwarming show there. Well, that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.